This episode was produced on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. We pay our respects to the elders, past and present. Their systems of law and knowledge long predated that of the modern lawyers who arrived in Australia, and they hold the memories, the traditions, the cultures, and the hopes of all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples.
Welcome to Unraveled, the DWL podcast.
Diverse Women in Law is a not-for-profit organisation based in Sydney. Our aim is to empower and support diverse women in all stages of their legal studies and career. We aim to provide meaningful structural enablers and awareness-raising initiatives to overcome barriers faced by diverse women in the legal sector.
Well, hello. I am here with Justice Rachel Pepper. My name is Sharon Hall. I'm a barrister at the New South Wales Criminal Defence Bar, and Justice Pepper is of the Land and Environment Court here in New South Wales.
Hello, Sharon. I am. It's Rachel Pepper, and I am a judge of the Land and Environment Court of New South Wales, and I've been a judge for a little over 14 years.
Wow. That has gone very, very quickly, might I say.
It has. It's a long time since we were on the football pitch together.
Indeed, we did meet over football, and given you are a football tragic yourself, self-described, I might
say. Self-confessed, absolutely.
I think we need to start with what has been called possibly the most openly queer sporting event in history, the Women's World Cup. Firstly, have you recovered yet?
Barely. I was at the final last night. It was an absolutely spectacular game to watch. Hard fought by both teams. The better team won. But an absolutely magnificent occasion to see so many people, packed stadium, almost 76,000 supporting women and women, basically women's sport, and in particular football. And you're quite right. I mean, the I guess, makeup of many of the teams is predominantly queer. And what struck me about that is how, in a sense, little has been said of it, which is really pleasing. The focus has been on the women, the football, the talents, the strengths, the weaknesses of the teams and so on. And there hasn't been sort of a titillating fascination with the sexual preferences or sex lives of the players, as there shouldn't be.
Yeah. What do you think having so many openly queer participants in the World Cup has done for the LGBTQI plus community?
Well, you can't be what you can't see, as the saying goes, and it's really fabulous to have, I think, positive role models there for people who are either coming out, people who have come out. I think it's really important that visibility is absolutely critical. And as I said before, that visibility in a way that hasn't been sensationalized. There were a few minor attempts by some of the more right-wing newspapers, but that appeared to be quickly shut down or at least ignored. And as I said, the focus was just on excellence in sport and excellence in sort of women's participation in sport. And it's that role model that is so important.
I think that's an excellent point you touch on there about the fact that it hasn't been that sort of obsession with people's sex lives or their who they're sleeping with, what gender that person is, what gender they are themselves identifying as, because it does go to show that we can get on with doing the job, whatever that job might be, in a way that shows the importance of diversity, but the fact that we don't always have to be sticking out. We can actually do the job and do it well, and people can focus on our talents rather
yes,
than
exactly.
that difference.
You focus on the substance, not necessarily the form, which is as it should be.
Yeah. You're currently on the board of 2010 and were previously on the board of ACON. Why is it so important for the LGBTQI plus community to be active participants in these types of organisations?
Well, firstly, they need all the volunteers they can get because most of these organisations, particularly 2010, run on a very limited budget. So I think it's important to give back to the community. But it's also, I think, important to bring your lived experience to boards and organisations such as those. I mean, boards are, whether it's in the queer community or any other community, they need diversity. So they need to have people there who represent all walks of life, all walks of the queer community, whether it's gay, lesbian, transgender, you know, non-binary, whatever that may be. I think it's important to put your hand up and give back. And as I said, you know, have that bring that lived experience and bring the other talents that you may have acquired during your professional life to the board.
And what do you personally get out of those roles?
I personally get a sense of community, which I think it's probably fair to say. While there are many queer participants in the legal community, there are nevertheless few. So for me, it's important to have that balance in my life where I can go back and be basically amongst my own people. It gives me a sense of, community participation, a sense of belonging.
Well, you have introduced the law into the discussion, so perhaps we'll move on to a discussion of LGBTQI plus practitioners and participants in the law. You were called to the bar in 1997 and practiced until your appointment in 2009. Firstly, did you have any issues being out in chambers?
I didn't know, and I was very fortunate in that regard. And I understand that others who I won't name did in other chambers, but I was the beneficiary of a chambers where I had Nye Parham, now Justice Parham of the Federal Court, who was out in chambers. And indeed, of course, my chamber, also one of the former floor members of my chambers was Justice Michael Kirby. So we had a strong tradition on level 12, Wentworth Selborne, of, open out gay barristers, and that I think made my life very easy indeed.
Was that the reason you chose to go to that chambers, or just happenstance?
In part, yes, it was. Absolutely. In part, absolutely. Because again, I had role models there. I had people who had walked that walk before me, and it was okay for them, and they had a positive experience. And again, people had focused on the substance, not the form. And so I thought that that would be an appropriate place for me.
Right. And it turned out that it was?
And it turned out that it was. I stayed there very happily until I was appointed to the bench.
More broadly, outside of chambers, during your time in practice, did you ever experience any overt homophobia or discrimination?
I haven't actually. And when I thought about this question earlier, I was surprised by the answer I came up with. Now, we have all sorts of laws in this country, at least in the state, anti-discrimination laws, vilification laws, which protect against the more overt forms of discrimination based on sexuality. And perhaps that's why. But no, overt, no, I did not. But whether or not it was there and I just wasn't aware of it, whether that was there in terms of briefing or whatever that may be, I can't say.
Did you feel like, I appreciate this is a question without notice, did you feel like being a barrister, so being slightly more senior member of the profession, protected you a little bit from that discrimination?
It meant that I was aware of my rights, and I think that helps great, you know, a great deal. When you're aware of your rights, I think you've got a much better ability to stand up for yourself. And I think it meant that the people working around me also knew that I was aware of my rights as well. And so if there were comments, they were kept to themselves.
Did you feel that the bar was a place that supported LGBTQI plus practitioners?
I'm not sure that we were thought of in that way when I went to the bar. You were just out. I don't think there was a sufficient visible cohort that allowed that community to be identified and therefore protected per se. I think it's gotten a lot better. There's now a regular sort of drinks hosted by I think a gay bar, Martin Place Chambers, where people can come together. There's celebrations around Mardi Gras time. I think there's just, again, that greater visibility. I think there's a greater awareness of transgender people and the issues that they face and non-binary people. I think there's greater awareness of the use of language, of not making assumptions, of not asking what your husband does, for example, in my case at least. I think people are a little bit more cognizant now than they were then when I joined the bar.
It's interesting you say that because I was arranging one of those very drinks functions of which you speak and specifically had targeted a number of members of the judiciary to come, but also generally invited the judiciary. And a Supreme Court judge sent an email unable to attend, but saying that this particular person wished that those functions were around when they were at the bar because it would have made their life in chambers much, much easier. And it certainly gave me some insight into the difficulties that practitioners have experienced over the years, notwithstanding their seniority, that it's been less comfortable for some. Obviously, you've had an excellent run, and that's to be applauded. But certainly there's some that haven't, whether it's by the design of other people or whether it's just in their own skin, haven't felt comfortable or confident enough to really embrace that chambers lifestyle because they felt that they didn't conform with the expectations of everybody else in chambers.
Yeah, that must undoubtedly be the case. I mean, things are undoubtedly changing for the better. You described me as having an excellent run. I've had a more charmed run than others, but I haven't always felt comfortable. Again, that question of, oh, so what does your husband do? Or do you have children? Or, oh, well, obviously you don't have children because you're in a same-sex relationship. All those sorts of assumptions, which you then have to, you know, deal with and debunk are tedious at the least and exhausting at the worst. Mm-hmm. And they to a certain extent still persist. I just haven't, as I said, experienced the overt forms of discrimination, but I don't know. I'm curious to know whether or not you have, Sharon, in your time at the bar.
Certainly not at the bar. I think when I came to the bar, I was out and everyone in my chambers knew that. There was no one else in my chambers who was out at the time. And so it meant I was the only one. However, I was going to a place where I was comfortable, where I knew so many people. I'd instructed most of the people in chambers. And so I felt comfortable going there, that there was going to be no discrimination, at least certainly nothing, again, overt. Yeah. And I find that practicing in crime is perhaps slightly different to what we would describe as uptown, where crime tends to be thought of as somewhere where there's less distinction about in terms of gender stereotypes, that we don't, for example, brief women. Those are things in crime we haven't struggled as hard. There's certainly still a struggle in some aspects, particularly when it comes to senior counsel and briefs going to senior counsel, but across the board, particularly for junior counsel, women have done very well at the criminal bar. And so I felt confident both as a woman and being out that I wasn't going to experience that discrimination. As a solicitor, it was slightly different. I felt like, and this is something I've spoken about a little bit, that I needed to, I felt like a lot of people were talking about me and that I had no control over that. And so when I left that particular job and moved on, I really wanted to control my own narrative. I didn't want people talking about me. I wanted to be the one that said, this is what I am. I didn't want everybody else saying, you know, oh, that client only likes her because they're both, you know, lesbians. I just didn't appreciate that at all.
Right. I see.
I rather suspect you like me because I was good at my job, but
yeah, yeah, we all want to be exactly. You want to be recognized for who you are because you're just competent and you know good at your job.
Especially when you're more junior, I think, because you are trying to, you know, give an impression and you're trying to lay a foundation for what your reputation's going to be like. And you don't want to be starting out as everyone's just focused on my sexuality. No one's focused on that I'm actually doing the job and I'm doing it well.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, something that can be a bit more difficult, particularly I think when people are working in firms or bigger firms where they don't get to lay that foundation of who they are before the gossip starts.
Well, what's your advice for people who are, say, joining a firm and who find themselves in that situation? What's your advice to that young graduate solicitor?
I think it's a little bit difficult because I've never worked in a really big firm, but I do think from what I have learnt of the big firms, that there are much more supportive networks that are available. And if it were me, I would try and really hook into those supportive networks. I know most of the big firms have diversity committees. They have particular groups that are supportive of the various interests and interest groups. And I would really reach out to those groups and try and get some support that way. I appreciate sometimes they can have their own internal difficulties, but I think that's a really good way of trying to get some support. But I also, I mean, my sort of catchphrase these days is control your own narrative. You know, you try as much as you can, you can't always, but you try and control, you know, what the information is about you and how that's being used by other people as much as you can, as much as you ever can when people are talking about you. And as we both know, people will say what they want to say. But if you can control that as much as possible and get the support where it's available, I think you're off to a pretty good start.
And perhaps ignore the haters.
Oh,
to the extent that they are any, just you have to, I think, try and block that noise out and focus on, you know, what you're doing, do it well, and merit will always out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, having served on bar council for a number of years while you were at the bar, do you have a view on what the leadership of the bar could do to support LGBTQI plus barristers more?
Well, I think you touched upon it in your previous answer to one of my questions about sort of having support groups in place, having diversity committees in place, raising visibility, perhaps training members in terms of, you know, appropriate use of pronouns, making sure people are aware of the issues that the queer community faces in the workplace. I think all those things are really important. Now, that is happening. I'm pleased to say that is happening, I think we're reaping positive benefits as a consequence.
And are your colleagues on the bench as open-minded and as accepting as your Chambers colleagues?
Absolutely. I've never had any difficulties on the court whatsoever, which has been fantastic. I should say that we're a majority female court now, which is wonderful. Ever since I joined the court, it's never been an issue.
Does being on the bench give you a different perspective on practitioners and in particular LGBTQI plus practitioners?
Not necessarily, no, in as much as when people come into the courtroom, they have a particular role to play and I have expectations around how they will perform in that role. And certainly from my point, and maybe that's because this is me and I am part of the queer community, I look beyond that. I just want someone there who's going to do their job properly, competently, represent their client, assist the court. That's what I need. So I guess there's the neutrality of the law, I think, does come into play. Interestingly, though, I have had a few cases where some of the principal actors or parties have been part of the queer community, and that's in part explained their behavior and why they are before the court. And I think it's fair to say that I've had a greater sympathy to the types of issues they have experienced, and which has led them to have, in most cases, an unhappy encounter with the law. And this is why I think diversity on the bench is so critically important. You can't just have a bunch of, with all due respect to some of my colleagues, white straight men being appointed to the bench. You need to have diversity.
I was hearing a story recently about a family court matter where a barrister had told the judge that their client was, I think it was non-binary and didn't adhere to the usual pronouns and had a preference to be addressed in a particular way. And the judge said, oh, well, I'm old-fashioned, so let's just do it the old-fashioned way, and insisted on either a Mr. or a Miss or something of that nature. Have you yourself ever experienced from the bench, either practitioners or participants in the judicial proceedings who have felt ostracised or perhaps not heard because of issues like that?
Again, I can't speak for the other judges, but for myself, because I'm part of the queer community, which is, again, I go back to the point of this is why you need to have diversity on the bench. You know, I ask people what pronouns they would prefer now. That's what I do. In my judgments, I don't use pronouns unless, it happens to be, well, I just don't use pronouns. I just use people's surnames. And that's something it's a conscious choice I've made. And that's because I have, I guess, that background and that knowledge. But I'm aware of those issues. It may well be that some of my colleagues aren't, but certainly where I've been able to, I've tried to educate them.
Do you think the bench would be assisted by a guide for addressing people who are gender diverse or non-binary?
Absolutely. I think not only just a guide, but some education as well. And that's something that I think should be done from the get-go at what's euphemistically called Baby Judges School, which is the week-long course that is put on for new judges. But that's where that training should start and should continue. But at the very least, there should be a guide. But I would like to see across-the-board training for all members of the judiciary and members of the bar as well. I think it's important because then I mean, often if you're a witness, you're there in a very vulnerable position. You're looking, I guess, to your counsel for some sort of protection, if you will. And I think it would be quite useful to have the barrister stand up and go, Your Honour, my client prefers to be addressed as, you know, them, they.
Yeah. Happily, I can report that I'm in the process of liaising with the Law Society and other groups to try and put together that very same guide.
Oh, good.
And hopefully we're optimistic that we can put together a guide and it would be distributed throughout the profession. So it wouldn't just be judges. It would go right across the profession. And in conjunction with some seminars, we're hopeful to be able to engage the profession to put together some education that will help people, because a number of people have different issues, whether they themselves are LGBTQI+. People are having witnesses or clients who...
Absolutely.
And their issue is, I don't want to embarrass myself. I don't want to offend this person, and I'm not sure how to raise the topic. I'm not sure how to address the issues. And I think if we can do that, it will make the profession more progressive, and it means that people who are interacting with the justice system feel like they are being heard.
Yeah, absolutely. More, not only just more progressive, but more inclusive as well, which is very important. And yes, people must be heard. They must feel like they have been heard, and they must be heard. And if you're being misgendered, deliberately, in the case of or in the example that you gave, then, you know, that's you're automatically excluded from the process from the get-go, which is you know, regrettable for a whole range of reasons. But I think that's an excellent idea.
Oh, good. Onwards we shall go with that. Do you have any advice for LGBTQI practitioners who are starting out their careers?
Be yourself. If you can. I appreciate that in some cases people may not, and there for a whole range of reasons, people may not feel comfortable being their true self. My senses and my experience tells me that if you can be your true self, and, you know, work hard and just, as you said, control your own narrative, focus on the work, focus on the competencies, merit will out. Merit will almost always out.
Yeah. And I think we've probably come full circle, but does the Women's World Cup have anything to teach us as lawyers about how we can be more inclusive?
Again, I think it's about being, about working hard, but being true to yourself. You looked at all those women out there, they were all true to themselves. They didn't showcase the fact necessarily that they were part of the queer community. They got on with the job and they worked hard. And in many cases, their rewards were manifest. And I think that's the sort of the message that, that as at least that's what I saw when I watched the games, either live or on the television. I saw these incredibly strong women who were just doing an excellent job and encouraging generations of younger women, encouraging generations of younger men, and encouraging generations of people in between as well, which was fantastic about being yourself. And with hard work, you get onto the world stage.
Which seems to be precisely what you have done yourself, Justice Pepper. Thank you very much for all of those words of wisdom that you have shared with us today, both in relation to football and the law. And it's been excellent talking to you today.
Thank you very much, Sharon. I'm pleased to say that I've ended up being much better at one than the other. I'll let the audience decide which.